Johnson versus CP Chemicals.
About though is the deliberate intent standard.
That is precisely correct.
And if you have, you know, it's not just the activist liberal judges on this court or whatever we are, the three or four of us, whoever it might be, there's a lot of judges that have said this now all around the state, that the deliberate intent to cause the injury to another is a standard that doesn't fly, certainly with regard to the trial by jury. Right.
I would respectfully honor the opinions and respect the opinions of those who so advocate that. I would, however, point out that it is not the province of the judiciary, but rather the province of the General Assembly to determine what shall henceforth be the law, what shall henceforth be the elements of this or any other court. It is the domain of this court to announce what the law is or has been. Hasn't been in Lancashire for a few. But here, acting under its police power, acting under Article 2, Section 1, the broadest range of authority in the legislative domain, the legislature has simply determined to modify what previously has been.
But they must do that within the confines of the Constitution.
And that is the only limiting factor.
That is
correct.
They don't have carte blanche to do whatever they choose to do.
Well, certainly not. However, under the analysis which controls here, the legislature need only have a rational basis, any rational basis on which it could have made its determination.
What could have that rational basis been? For, I'd like you to explain, get very to the heart of the argument, two things. What is the legitimate government interest, number one, to require deliberate intentional acts, and also to raise the standard to clear and convincing? What is that?
Well, if I could say in many lessons, I'm going to with my time, I'm going to suggest to you that as Justice Douglas wrote in his dissenting opinion has been fraught, this area of the law has been fraught with confusion, short decision, and may rather accomplish the seemingly, I think, the possibility of making this area a lot more confusing. The legislature certainly may have to act in the Atlantic Act by clarifying. I would also point out to you that our neighboring states in Michigan and West Virginia have both gone through precisely this analysis, and the Supreme Court in those states have in fact recognized and acknowledged the deliberate intentional standard is now the applicable law, according to the Supreme Court in those states. A rational legislator concerned about job formation, you know, might very well be concerned that a company, a Honda, contemplating a new manufacturing facility in this part of the country might very well be inclined to move to a neighboring state because of the confusion of the law and the different standards in the Ohio law. This statute is not revolutionary in any way. This statute returns the state of law in Ohio to that which existed in 1911. When the Workers' Compensation Act was first enacted, the Norris Act, under the police power, not under Article 2, Section 35, not under Article 2, Section 34, because neither existed at the time. Under Article 2, Section 1, police power, and the Norris Act provided there shall be a workers' compensation system.
Well, so we should be returning to the conditions that existed in factories in 1911?
No. In fact, your decision in Blankenship, in Jones, in Van Fossen, and Brady have urged that there should be a recognition of a right in the name of an employee intentionally injured at work to bring a private cause of action. That, in fact, was the state of the law in 1911 when this workers' compensation system was first enacted. The Gildersleeve decision pronounced by this court in 1924 recognized that an intentional, quote, employment intentional court cause of action should exist even within, even in a system where there is a workers' compensation system. However, the return, which I think to the Gildersleeve year, the 1911, is that the level of intent required by the employee to prove his employment intentional court case was willful act, a purposeful, intentional act designed to injure the employee.
Which would be actionable under the new statute.
I can think of a situation in which there is a breakdown in the hallway, and this afternoon when I return to my law office, and I become distressed at the state of affairs, and I take an action, commit a battery, for example, against an employee within my frustrated.
So what if you say, I didn't mean to do it? I didn't mean to injure. I just lost my temper.
All intentional courts, all courts which require specific intent, not just this one, would be subject of that question. The General Assembly has power under Article 2, Section 1 to determine what shall be the element of tort. If the General Assembly determines to change the standard of intent for the court of defamation,
Let me put another qualifier on it. Can you lay out a fact pattern that wouldn't be a criminal act of fraud or that would be actionable?
I'm not certain that the fact pattern I just have on the compliance would be a criminal act. I'm not certain that I would be a criminal battery. In that case, if I became frustrated at work and lash out deliberately and intentionally lash out, with the intention to strike an employee, cause injury in my frustration, I'm not a criminal lawyer, I'm not certain that's a crime or not.
But I guess that's what struck me in reading the statute, is that it's confusing me, and in effect, it's really limited to causes of action that would underline it really rise to the level of the crime.
Well, I don't think we're here to hypothesize on any particular other cases that might arise. That is an interesting question. However, this case presents itself on the back presented by the plaintiff Johnson, and in the plaintiff Johnson case, we are presented with a statute which the Constitution authorizes the legislative authority doesn't require or does not involve the commission of any.
That's always true, Counselor, but we can't really dismiss it that easily. Let's just take, and I, like Justice Pfeiffer, am concerned about that, because short of an employer taking a gun and blowing somebody's brains out or taking a 2x4 and beating them over the head, and then even saying, well, I didn't mean it, I just mean to injure, I didn't mean to kill, or I didn't mean to even injure. Short of that, the standards set by the General Assembly for deliberate intent cannot be met. And you know, why would you have an employer come up and say, yeah, I meant to really kill my employee? Because then there really is a criminal charge. But let's forget that for a minute. You'd be surprised at how many cases we're seeing where an employer removes a safety guard from a specific piece of equipment. I mean, I'm continually amazed at seeing those cases come in. That wouldn't fit under this, would it?
It may or may not. It would depend on whether the removal was designed or deliberately intended to cause injury to an employee.
Oh, okay, let's stop right there then. In other words, the employer's got to come in and say, yeah, I removed that safety guard because I wanted him to cut his hand off.
Certainly not.
I mean, that's all that's left.
The court is well aware. In every court which requires a specific criminal intent in security law, in every certain fraud case which requires specific intent on the part of the actor. The actor rarely confesses in his or her deposition, yes, I intentionally lied to the investors so they would invest their money and I could take a vacation and retire to be a day to day. That doesn't happen. The circumstantial evidence is the proof of the case, just as it is in every other court.
Substantial certainty. Maybe more probable than not.
You sense that. Do you sense that? That the real problem here is that this court has set one standard which says substantially certain an employer does something which is substantially certain to cause a result, which is certainly something less than an intentional act. We've set that standard. The General Assembly has enacted legislation that sets a different standard, and some people don't like that. Is that really what's... You know, to cut away all the constitutional arguments and so forth, that's really the issue.
I think that there's too much flair. This isn't an issue of labor versus management or that one political philosophy versus another. This is simply a case where this court said an intentional tort can be met in a case where there is action taken with a substantial certainty. The General Assembly has simply determined to change the burden of proof required, or rather to change the level of specific intent that's required. And the General Assembly may do, but in fact, the General Assembly has not been abolished entirely because of that. It didn't support the investment, just to modify the element.
My second question is we've seen some cases here in which the commission or the bureau does not award compensation because the conduct is reckless. Employer's conduct is reckless. It's not negligent. It doesn't meet the standard of intentional tort that the court has established. Does the statute leave a gap? Is there a gap here? If we say the statute is constitutional and the deliberate conduct is the test, what happens to the cases in which the employer is deemed to be reckless?
I don't perceive a gap, Your Honor. I think that even going back to the days of your Gildersleeve decision, that more than reckless conduct was required. Still, with one of your decisions in that case, provides that a willful act of discrimination and act unknowingly and purposely with the direct object of injuring another, with the conscious intention to inflict injury upon some person. That act must have been in this court. And it goes on to say that more than recklessness is required. I think it's simply a question of working out over time the rights of injured persons. Jones or PIT, for example, stands the proposition that injured employees need not be left between an intentional tort claim and a claim of benefits, and the law ought not allow them to get.
Counsel, did BP manufacture the spray head that burst?
It did not, but it is alleged to have done so at this point.
The evidence shows that it did not?
There hasn't been any evidence because this case was disposed of on 12 months. But it is alleged that it is.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkinson. Mr. Ray.
Sounding melodramatic. I don't see this case as a case about that they're going to get the Ohio Rookie. What we really do have here is a preoccupation that comes from sources that have lobbied effectively to pass the statute that I would submit to need to work.
Isn't that a policy argument, even if everyone on this bench said, boy, that's right? Are we the wrong place to make that argument, Counselor?
I feel like you're wrong, that I can make a policy argument because the argument supports the policy.
Okay.
So let me suggest that as we get directly to the legal argument, it's multiple choice here, that the unconstitutionality of the statute, equal protection, has clearly been violated. Here we have an individual court that went its way through the common law process and developed, I think, with clarity, not with any confusion we get when we get to fight with subpoena. The elements are very clear as to what is required to prove an invention for the common law to brought against an employer by an employee. It is very clear, it is abundantly clear that, as this court has repeatedly said, that an employer intentional tort falls outside of the course and scope of the employer-employee relationship. And for that reason, when one looks at Article 2, Section 34, and one looks at Article 2, Section 35 of the Ohio Constitution, there's no question that the legislature exceeded its bounds here. The legislature was given an admonition to the Constitution that the legislature had an obligation to provide for the safety and general welfare of employees in Article 2, Section 34. Article 2, Section 35 also provides an impersonal limitation on what the legislature can do as far as acting on compensating employees who are injured in the workplace. So what has happened here? We have this law that has been passed. It calls itself an employer intentional tort law. But when one gets beyond the title of the statute, there's really no tort that can be made. This court has seen on many occasions removal of guards from machines. This court has seen on many occasions the mislabeling or removal of labels from toxic chemicals in the workplace. This statute does not provide a right of action. Therefore, as the court will get the next of the elements of our moral choice, there's no meaningful limit here. To prove that there is both deliberate and intentional conduct goes beyond the scheme of any kind of mens rea that has ever been required in civil law in this state. So what's happened here? This court has been so segregated by placing it at a level where proof is a virtual impossibility that there's no real tort law.
Well, there's a meaningful remedy, workers' compensation.
Correct, Your Honor. What workers' compensation is intended to provide. But we're not talking about an act that occurs within the course and scope of employment.
Mr. Ray, that is, though, the reason, isn't it, that this can be distinguished from other torts, is that it's a function of a scheme, the quid pro quo that was struck many, many moons ago that said employees don't have to prove anything. They get compensated for injuries in the scope. You know the trade-off. That does distinguish this scenario from other torts, doesn't it?
It would if that were really the court at hand.
Okay. You say it's not a sufficient remedy for something that occurs outside the scope, and yet other states have said that you can't, this court has said that, but it's a, as one brief called it, a gross legal fiction to say that something that happens in the factory during work time is outside, totally unrelated to the work.
I would hope that the court, Your Honor, would not see this as a gross violation. If we got to that point, then again, I get back to my basic policy theme that's supported by the constitutional argument. Do we really mean the worker? We get to that point where the worker has no cause of action, where there is an activity that is never contemplated by the worker. So he shows up every day diligently trying to do this or her job, and then is faced with the complexity of having no choice but to work on a machine that has been altered to speed up the fabrication process with no thought of safety of the worker in mind. In fact, the standing certainty of injury, the very form of definition of an intentional
hustle in crafting to where you would like to go. How does the employer deal with corrected a dangerous situation in the workplace that needs to be addressed? Whether it's a group that doesn't have adequate support in it, or conjure up the dangers that you might. And the employer is, we've got a problem. Take that pattern here. At this point, you get the leaves and cracks and problems. And the employer says, we've got to fix this thing. And the supervisor wants to think and they undertake all of the safety precautions to say, you know, how to take it. Send employees into harm's way, knowing they're sending them into harm's way, not knowing for sure that something bad is going to happen. And the employees to take care of all due care known to mankind is going to happen. Is that going to be an intentional force? Is that going to fit into? Is that going to be actionable?
Well, you're right. That's just what I'm saying. The aspect of that that you do, I can't tell you. But I can tell you that every day, of course, there's a work better than any of us in our wives involved. In fact, the client does give us excellent instruction and provides an employer stays with the known hazard. If the employer has knowledge of a hazard in the workplace, and that hazard creates substantial certainty of injury, the employer has an obligation to remove that hazard. If the employer does not remove that hazard and then places the employee in harm's way with that knowledge, knowing that there is, with that knowledge of that hazard and that hazard creates substantial certainty of injury, we've got the three-pronged definition of the but it would suggest that every case rises and falls on its own. But I would also tell the court that it's surprising to my little office, my little office, where I just don't think I'm going to see one of these figures. Or a guard, where the activity is so outrageous that it literally shocks the kind of person who takes in the fact that the injured person sitting across from you is near death. Telling you the scenario that put that person in harm's way. First, there's disbelief. But it regularly happens in our office. I don't know what to tell the court other than this intentional tort statute needs to be there because, although I wouldn't suggest that it's a wholesale problem, it's enough of a problem because we see it enough in my little office that it's something that needs to be preserved for the world. Remember that this is a property right, essentially, that a meaningful remedy for that property right was that because intentional tort was a tort as a matter of law by the time the Constitution was put in place in this state. This court has said in that first, when there is a cause of action in place, that is a vested property right. And to take away that vested property right is a denial of a right to due process and fits in with the meaningful remedy argument that I've been
the General Assembly had adopted legislation that reiterated our last opinion on intentional tort, what would your argument be? They have the authority to do that, constitutional authority to do that?
I think, Your Honor, that the General Assembly can codify law. For example, private liability law. Largely a codification, although there's been spoken about that. But if we get to the issue of codification of intentional tort law, it's one thing to codify, it's another thing to have risen to essentially nullify the problem of anti-country.
So when the General Assembly modifies common law, it must not make the law more disadvantageous to one party than the other, than the court has? Is that a principle that we...
I think that what you suggest does fit nicely with American legal protection for responsive action in court.
Wouldn't that stagnate the law? I mean, that isn't the General Assembly's powers are plenary, aren't they, counsel, except for being limited by the Constitution? And then you say, well, it's the broad due process right to always have whatever causes of action exist. That isn't the law.
The General Assembly can't create new laws. They
can set elements. Okay. A property right, only when does one acquire a property right in a potential injury?
The property right that is an actual injury, because the actual injury is demonstrated in court with a cause of action. And Your Honor, this court has said, the United States Supreme Court has said, that when a cause of action is already vested, that is a property right.
Not the existence. You're surely not talking about the existence of a tort in the common law. Is a vested property right? Okay.
If we go back to the basic court of trespass in the common law, this court has proved that trespass predated the enactment of the Ohio Constitution, and it came all the way there. If this court is a real court and is a cause of action that's provided through the common law that is a vested property right to a rich and take away that property right to make it ineffectual, it's a denial of due process and a denial of right to property. We don't even have to take that as a multiple choice answer. We still have the others that I've discussed.
So basically, if any legislation codifies what we've done,
that's an excellent point. I'm not suggesting the court that that's the way this should happen at all.
That's what we said. Once we make a decision on this, you're saying legislation is not going to be any other than the reality that you have to be right. It's not lying. It's not right.
Your Honor, let me put on the rest of the paragraph. Because the rest of the paragraph requires that the legislature is going to address the codification of a common law cause of action. It must be done within the constitutional requisites of due process, the constitutional requisites of legal protection, and constitutional limitations that impose on the legislature. If we look just at equal.
But that's a lot different than saying what we decide what the law should be.
I don't think we do disagree, Your Honor. I think we do agree that the legislature has that right. But if the legislature steps over the line and violates equal protection, as it has here, for example, let me give you an example.
Okay. Let's go back to your guard argument. We all need to take guards off. It's a deliberate act. There are a lot of negative results of deliberate acts that really only fall in the sense of negative. And you could have a guard that's not very sophisticated, guard is not a chance of certainty, but 1 out of 100 workers get injured, and now you have a worker's comp thing. And what we see up here over and over and over are almost everything that happens becomes an intentional act, and it's due to harm, and it's due to
that you have the right to codify what they think the public policy should be on that. When a worker is already compensated by a work company, another worker that can get an ESSR, extra compensation is a deliberate violation of the safety standards. Those, in fact, are a separation from the average person after the completion of the work. You don't have a level playing field. You don't have these protections. You don't have someone out there with worker comp protection that can do under the government standards.
Let me address the first part of your comment. That is to say, the common rash losses. This court has seen claims, cases that are used on meritorious. We get lines of defense lawyers in this town and outside of this town with the outset of lawsuits by a cop who said that I am meritorious, that they'll never get to a jury, that I had no business filing this lawsuit. And it smacks it from us. Now, if we got that point, we're going to close the court down to order just because the frivolousness is out here, where the last merit is there. Then we've gone to the request of what courts do. Courts have to make those decisions. Courts have to decide if the lawsuit is frivolous. Courts have to determine if there is a last merit. Just because a group of people don't like employer intentional torts doesn't mean that means it's the end of it. Just because there may be, and I don't know this because I don't have the data, more than a share of frivolous lawsuits that are within the category of employer intentional torts, does that mean that we eliminate the torts by giving such a burden to the plaintiff that there's no way that the plaintiff can do it? I would submit that we're closing the court down for that's not what this court does. This court is here to protect rights, both the employer and the employee. What happened here is the legislature went too far. When the legislature put the liver in there, it went so far as to put an element in the statute that went beyond criminal cases by prosecutors years ago as a criminal prosecutor. And what we have here is a denial of meaningful remedy. What we have here is a denial of due process. And what we have here is such a permutation of what was a reasonable basis for C with an employer central court. The legislature violated the Constitution. The equal playing field is called the legal litigator point. This case stands. This is the statute.
Mr. Ray, let me ask you, what do you think happens, or what becomes of the reckless conduct of an employer under the, if this statute were to be held constitutional? Does that become a workers' comp, run standard workers' comp?
Well, I think it's one thing Van Bossen did before. Van Bossen's reckless conduct does not rise to the level of an employer intentional tort under the common law.
Okay, so before you sit down, Justice Green raised a question of how the case relates to the manufacture of the stuff. That's out of here.
Yes, for the dual capacity issue, I would suggest that the court should take a good hard look at my answer to the part of my line to create a case note for being a dual capacity sitting in chambers. We learned that the decision had come down to the court and the court was not the lawyer and said,
this is not a case about the statute, but the bridge, of course, is a
the close call here is the most difficult part of the case is whether or not Ian can redefine the word. The definition is so narrow that for all practical purposes, the court has been eliminated. In other words, it's an elimination wrapped up in the close.
Certainly the fact that this case don't frame you for that point because this is a Rule 12 case. In 23.05.29, the General Assembly did go so far as to only abolish causes of action. And I recall, as I wrote to the sponsor, the first draft of the bill, let's be careful not to take away the vested rights of people who already have vested causes of action. That wasn't done in this case. This General Assembly was as careful. This statute works only for the section. And Mr. Chief Justice, I would further respond to your question, me and Mr. Ray, about the recklessness issue and the gap. It's just you, as Justice Douglas wrote in his dissent in Boston. This has been an area of law which has been so confused since 1982 that there has been disparate interpretation, confused interpretation, and this statute lends clarity. Let us allow this statute to work its way through the judicial system based on the facts of real cases and a real trial and allow a body supplemented by a full record to come to this court before you lead to the conclusion that there's no plaintiff could be the standard here. But just as this court ruled in the Munger case, actions such as intentional infliction of emotional distress by an employer implicitly upon an employee aren't denied by Article 2, Section 35. Criminal conduct isn't necessarily required. There are many devices in the law through the SSR, OSHA enforcement, and such mechanisms to punish the employer who removes the safety guard and act irresponsibly enough.
To back up this section,
to say the mortgage understands
what
you should do, you should say the mortgage should be in the
case,
right? To get the
constitutionality.
Submitted, you'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.